Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Jed York, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and CEO of the San Francisco 49ers, your chair for tonight's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. As you know from recent stories in the news, injuries in professional sports are a very big deal. There are a lot of myths, there are a lot of facts, and tonight we're here to talk about them and answer questions that are pertinent to the game and pertinent to your children and loved ones that might play the game. You're going to hear an up-close personal interview with some great sports figures, folks that know this topic inside and out, and you're going to have information and hopefully a little bit of humor and some lessons that you can learn. To introduce two of our distinguished speakers, it's my pleasure to introduce the third panelist of tonight's program, Dr. John York. Dr. York is a business entrepreneur, a physician by training. He and his wife, Denise DeBartolo York, are co-chairman and owner of the San Francisco 49ers, and they get a lot of blame for things that happen in public and not often enough praise when things go well with the San Francisco 49ers. Dr. York is a graduate from the University of Notre Dame. He received his medical degree from Loyola University of Chicago, Stritch Medical School. Dr. York is also the chairman of the NFL's Health and Safety Advisory Committee. He's very involved with the 49ers Foundation, which helps keep kids safe on track and in school, a foundation that's given over $16 million back to San Francisco Bay Area children in the last 16 years. I'm also proud to say that he is my father, and if I didn't say good words, well, I'd probably be in trouble when I got home. So please welcome Dr. John York.
Well, Jeb, thank you very much, and I'm very pleased to be here at the Commonwealth Club tonight. And I don't think there is a Hall of Fame in medicine, but if there was, I get to introduce two Hall of Famers in two different professions. The first is Dr. Brent Eastman, and he is the Chief Medical Officer and Corporate Senior Vice President of Scripps Health in La Jolla, California. He is the N. Paul Whittier Chair of Trauma, and he is the President-elect of the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Eastman's clinical involvement with Scripps is focused on trauma care and trauma systems. And that word system is going to come up again in this bio that I'm going to give, and I believe it will come up tonight also in the presentation. Dr. Eastman oversees clinical quality, graduate medical education programs, disaster preparedness, clinical research, and other key issues across the Scripps system. Dr. Eastman is not new to San Francisco. He got his medical degree at UCSF and also completed his general surgical residency and served as chief resident at UCSF. He did another year of surgical training at Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital in England. And he started his career at Scripps in 1972 in the practice of general, vascular, and trauma surgery. Dr. Eastman is a co-founder of the San Diego County Trauma System. There's that word system again, that is regarded as a worldwide model. And this is what that system has done. The percentage of preventable trauma deaths in the San Diego regional hospitals stood at 22% prior to the trauma system being put into place. With that system put into place, the percentage of preventable deaths has declined to approximately 1%. And Dr. Eastman has helped develop this trauma system not only in the San Diego area, but throughout the world, in the U.S., England, Australia, Brazil, Argentina, Canada, Mexico, South Africa, India, and Pakistan. In addition to this work, he has worked on the research agenda at the Center for Disease Control. He's been a visiting surgeon in the combat casualty program of the U.S. military hospitals. Dr. Eastman has co-authored and authored multiple publications. And tonight, he's going to talk to us about a very distinguished patient. While not always the doctor-patient relationship, they got to know each other after our next person had finished his career. But he knows a lot about the next person's career and the medical things that went along with that career. So our second guest is Mr. Dan Fouts, a Hall of Famer with the San Diego Chargers. He is a native of San Francisco, and his father, Bob, is here tonight. And while Dan was growing up, Bob was announcing the 49er games. So this is my first opportunity to meet Bob. So I've heard an awful lot about you. It's very nice to meet you. Dan graduated from Ignatius here in San Francisco, and he went to Oregon where he was a record-setting quarterback. He played along with Ahmad Rashad, also a very great NFL player, and coached and was coached by a couple of guys that you guys might know, George Seifert and John Robinson. Dan was drafted by the San Diego Chargers in 1973, and by the late 70s, Dan had become one of the top quarterbacks in the NFL, in a road that led him to a Hall of Fame career. He retired from the NFL after 15 seasons. He was a six-time Pro Bowler, and he was the pilot of Coach Air Coryell's offense. He earned multiple honors and set many records. He earned NFL and AFC Player of the Year honors in 1982, AFC Most Valuable Player in 1983, League Co-MVP in 83, and was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1993, the first year of his eligibility. That does not occur very often. Since 1988, Dan has been one of the nation's leading college and NFL football announcers. He and his lovely wife, Jerry, live in Oregon, and they are the proud parents of Dominic, Suzanne, Ryan, and Shannon. Dan, welcome. Dr. Eastman, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you very much, Dr. York. I know you're a pathologist, so if we get into some bloodletting here, I may well call on you for that particular piece of medical advice. Maybe the right way to begin this lecture, which is probably unlike any medical or sports lecture you've ever heard, is to tell you how it came to be. We were neighbors, my wife, Tika, who is here, and Dan, during Dan's playing career in San Diego, and we used to go to the games. I was a fan. And one day, Dan and I were sitting on his veranda, and as a trauma surgeon, I was impressed that Dan was sort of a living example of a survivor of trauma, and said, "Dan, do you think you can remember any of your injuries?" Well, over the next couple of hours and probably a couple of beers, Dan remembered, as you will see, every injury, not only every injury, but the assailant. We use the term in trauma surgery, the mechanism of injury. So you're going to see that about these injuries. This is how this lecture came to be. I wanted to do it for the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma, which is where we first did it. And I must say, looking at who has spoken at the Commonwealth Club prior to Dan and me, I'm not sure that this lecture is in the same league, but we're going to give it a try. I thought I might, Dr. York, tell you that I do have a relationship with the 49ers, and I have to tell you that my first view of NFL football, because I grew up in Wyoming, which did not have a football team of any kind.
Still don't.
Rodeos.
Never will.
Never will. least populous state in the Union. So, however, Moffitt Hospital and the UCSF Medical School, and these pictures are actually juxtapositioned about the way they are if you go up to Mount Parnassus. That's the medical school. That's the 13th floor of the medical school. That's where the gross anatomy lab was. That's where I used to spend my Sundays as a medical student. And we could see one end zone of Kezar Stadium. And that was my introduction to professional football, to the San Francisco 49ers. And Dan's father, who I've had the pleasure of getting to know over the years, of course, was the voice of the 49ers, going back, I think, to 1946. And in those years, and Dan, of course, was a ball boy at Kezar Stadium. So we have, even though we're from San Diego and Charger fans, we have definite 49er and San Francisco connections. I just want to make the point, for those of you who aren't trauma surgeons or even in medicine, that trauma surgery, which is what I do, has been called the two-minute offense of surgery, and that the trauma surgeon is the quarterback of the trauma team. So in that sense, I feel some credibility in talking with Dan in his role as quarterback and as he talks about the two-minute offense in football. When I say the two-minute offense in surgery, this is what I mean. When a trauma victim comes in the middle of the night, you have one of the greatest trauma centers in the United States, particularly in the world, at the San Francisco General Hospital. It was the first trauma center in the United States in 1966, and that's where I had the good fortune to train. I went to medical school and trained here in the 60s. Some of you appear to be old enough to maybe remember and appreciate the comment that was made that if you remember San Francisco in the 60s, you weren't here. But I spent most of my time in the operating room taking care of trauma patients, and I do. And we do have huddles in surgery like this where we confer about what to do. And in trauma surgery, it's a two-minute offense. You have to move quickly. We have timeouts. And we have checklists. You read about that today in medicine and in trauma surgery. We follow checklists very, very carefully. So let's get to the main subject of quarterback trauma, what we've called remembrance of injuries past. Dan has already been introduced, and these are sort of some of the things. That last one is my favorite, my friend, and NFL Hall of Fame. Tika and I, my wife and I, Bob, Dan's family, we were fortunate enough to be invited by Dan to go to Canton when he was inducted in the Hall of Fame. And that was really one of the more impressive ceremonies I've ever been to. Surgery doesn't come close to doing that, nor does have surgery have a Hall of Fame. But I think I'm going to recommend that for some of my peers. Just to let you know that Dan and I have taken this very seriously. This is my office at home. And I told you how this lecture first was born years ago on Dan's porch where we had a Heineken, and Dan reminisced about his injuries, and we put this lecture together for you at the Commonwealth Club at my office just a month or two ago. So we'll start with the person you really want to hear from, Dan, and we've heard the term Air Coryell, and two of my favorite stories, if Dan will tell them, is about motivational coaching. And coaches operate in very different ways. Tommy Prothero was very different than Don Coryell. And Dan, you might talk about Coach Prothero.
Well, Coach Prothero is a big Southern gentleman and with a slow Southern drawl and a different way of looking at football than I preferred. But fortunately for me, this one game, I was not playing. I was injured. How about that? So the second string quarterback is playing, and his name is Jesse Freitas, and played at Sarah High School. And we competed against each other a few times in high school. But Jesse was having a rough day against the Denver Broncos. And it was the third quarter, and we still hadn't made a first down. In fact, he'd only completed maybe two passes the entire first three quarters. And so on third down, Prothro sent out the punt team. And I've got the clipboard there, and I'm going, Coach, it's only third down. And he says, I know what down it is. Don't tell me what down it is. I know what down it is. Get out there, punt team. So we punted. They got the ball. And the next time we had the ball on offense, third down again, he says, punt team, get out there. I said, Coach, you can't. It's third down. You punt on fourth down. This is the NFL, right? He says, don't talk to me like that, Fouts. Punt team, go out there and kick. And after the game, the media was interested in this newfangled idea of punting on third down. And Prothro said, I felt we had a better idea of them fumbling the punt than we had of completing the pass. Thank God I was injured. He wasn't talking about me.
Now,
then Coach Coryell was a totally different guy, just wired so tight and just imaginative and innovative in what he thought about playing the game. And the way you watch the game now, you can directly relate it to his philosophy. You know, when you come over for that 2-minute warning, you always see the quarterback over there and he takes off his helmet, gets a glass of water, and the coaches are all buzzing around him. Well, I was talking to Jim Hanifin, who was our offensive line coach, later became the St. Louis Cardinals head coach. He's on the phone upstairs to Joe Gibbs, who won a couple of Super Bowls, three of them, with the Washington Redskins. And sitting next to him was Ernie Zampezi, our receiver coach. So three pretty good minds. And so Hanifin is telling me, okay, Dan, this first play we're going to run red right zoom, 844 Ricky. Now, what you want to do is look at the weak side linebacker. If you can get the ball into Charlie on the skinny post, go ahead. But if the safety cheats over there, then look for Kellen on the crossing route. Now, if the middle linebacker gets in the middle of the crossing route, you got JJ deep coming in on the curl. Now, if JJ is covered by the strong safety, then you got Capoletti sneaking out in the flat and Muncy coming out over the middle late. You got that? Sure, you know. And the referee comes over and says, okay, let's go. Time's in. And I start to run out to the huddle, and I feel this tug on my jersey, and it's Coryell. And he says, screw all that, just throw it to JJ. And I did, and, you know, first down.
Dan claims, I don't know if it's true or not, that that he could audibleize with Coryell, and his first option was always a touchdown. First and 10, fourth and 1, third and 9. And, of course, that was great. I remember in Canton when Coryell introduced Dan and a couple of other coaches were there, like Chuck Knowles and Jack Walsh, and they kept saying their quarterbacks were best. And I was so touched because Don Coryell said, well, you think that Bradshaw was the best and you think that Elway was the best, but I just have to tell you, Danny was the best because the only way you could beat the Chargers was one of two things. You either had to shut Danny down, or you had to score a lot of points. Now, most of you scored a lot of points, and they did, because I think most of the money went to offense in those days.
That's nothing wrong with that. Got to pay the quarterback.
So, Dan has been credited with being a thinking quarterback. Yogi Berra said it, 90% of the game is half mental. So let's get into the essence of this and the injuries that Dan told me about that day as I listened and took notes as a trauma surgeon. And we'll just walk through them. I, as a trauma surgeon, will just show you the way we look at things as a surgeon. What was the injury? What was the mechanism of injury? We don't tend to use the word assailant, although sometimes in crimes of violence that's appropriate. And then the recovery time. I'll just tell you ahead of time, the recovery time, I think, on every injury we're going to discuss was 1 week. Dan played the next Sunday. So, Dan, you might want to talk about left knee strain.
Well, you remember that great Rose Bowl team of the Stanford University Indians at the time, the Thunder Chickens, Dave Tipton, Pete Lazatich, just great players, and they had a really good team. And one of those chickens, as I was stepping to throw, came low. Now, you can't do that anymore in the NFL, but back in the old days when, you know, we played football, tackle football. So anyway, he hit me right on the side of the knee and stretched my medial collateral ligament, I think. Is that, Now, so I missed the next week's game. rehabbing that. And as far as whenever you stretch a ligament like that, it stays with you for a long time, especially, you know, 30 years after you quit playing. You have a tendency to feel these things still. But anyway, luckily I did not tear it.
And I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, and I won't bore you with going into detail about the anatomy of the knee or orthopedic injuries. But just from my point of view, the knee is a very, very potentially unstable joint. And to think what happens, I'm amazed that there are more injuries of medial and lateral collateral ligaments and the cruciate ligaments, which is what keeps your knee from going forward and back, the femur on the tibia, are these cruciate ligaments. So it's ingeniously designed, but I don't think it was designed for football. The next one is a right foot factor. This, again, appears to still be when you were playing college ball, Dan.
Yeah, this was in our Civil War game against the Beavers. I'm a Duck. They're the Beavers. And it's similar to Cal and Stanford. Okay, it's the last game of the year. Unfortunately, we hadn't beaten the Beavers at this point for 8 years in a row. So we're really into this one. We scored on the first play of the game, and when I got injured, it was 30-3, and we were on the 4-yard line going in for more. So you get the idea that we were going to get them good. It was 4 minutes to go in the game, and big fat Billy Joe Winchester fell on the back of my foot, and what happened is the balls of my feet actually hit my heel. And I got up off the ground. My foot was at a right angle like that. And nobody from the sideline was coming to get me. Hey, you know, look, it hurts. Anyway, so I kind of just stepped down on it and walked to the sidelines and asked the coach, why was I still in the game? Because it cost me the East-West game and another bowl game at that time. But the trouble with this injury is that it still bothers me because of the bone fragments that are on the top of the foot. And, in fact, that's the way I used to walk when I had my bad foot.
This diagram, you see a fracture, which is what Dan had, where his foot was hyperflexed and broke one of his metatarsals. You also see, he indicated there, a stress fracture. And we know, particularly with running being as popular as it is, we're talking about football injuries tonight, but stress fractures are another very, very big area. And sports medicine, as opposed to my specialty of trauma surgery per se, is huge. And I think one of the greatest advances in medicine has been the interest and the expertise in sports medicine. Left clavicle fracture, I'm going to show you what the clavicle is, which is more commonly known as the collarbone. Dan will talk about this, and we're aware of this in San Diego right now because our first-round draft pick last year, running back, broke his clavicle, I think, on the first play of the first game.
Yeah. But I really believe that injuries are really bad luck. Because we all train, we all lift weights, we all run, we all prepare. And there's just some things are going to happen that you have no control over. I broke my foot the last game of my college career. This is 6 months later at an All-Star game in Lubbock, Texas, third play of the game, and I get hit as I'm thrown and driven to the artificial turf and break my collarbone. Now, if that's not bad luck, I don't know what is. I hadn't been injured up until the broken foot or the knee, and then the broken foot. So it's all bad luck.
A right thumb fracture, Green Bay, Ted Hendricks. And some of these, and I was, I don't know if you'll be impressed. I was, Dan is thinking back a lot of years, and I couldn't believe he remembered actually the assailant, the person who broke his bone or broke his thumb. I had the feeling that there was some kind of a grudge still living there, but I don't know. Maybe he just had a good memory.
Well, Hendricks did play for the Raiders, so we all have grudges against them. And again, the thing about Ted Hendricks, you can see 6'7" and a wingspan so large that his nickname in college, and it followed him into the NFL, was the Stork. And just throwing the ball like that, stick up your hand, Brent. and he was trying to block the pass, and all he hit was my thumb, and he broke my thumb. Just a freak accident. Clean play, but it put me out for a while.
The thing, I've not had a broken foot nor a broken thumb, and maybe Dan will comment, but in terms of pain, I've been impressed as a trauma surgeon having somebody come in who's been in a major car crash with a ruptured liver, a head injury, a broken femur. But oftentimes, not oftentimes, but more consistently than not, a fracture of a finger, thumb, or finger, or toes, or the foot were more painful. I think the more distal you get into the extremities, the nervous system is such that the pain actually intensifies.
Well, what really intensified is that this injury happened in the second quarter. So I go into the locker room at halftime, they take an x-ray, I'm taking off my uniform and ready to hop in the shower, and Prosser says, "Where are you going, Phil?" I said, "I got a broken thumb, coach." He says, "Could put your uniform up back on. I want you to come on out there and see if you can take a snap." So taking a snap is putting your hands under the center and him bringing the ball up really hard. I pulled out early. I said he wasn't going to get my thumb again. So, coach, he didn't make me play, but he still made me stand there in Green Bay, Wisconsin, with my full uniform on and a cast on my hand.
We know that there's a lot of discussion these days about concussions, and Dan had one, not surprisingly. We'll talk about that. For those of you who are scholars in the audience, you may want to know where the term came from, and it is like so many terms we use in medicine from Latin, meaning to shake violently. And again, as a trauma surgeon, I deal with brain injury, with everything from concussion, which is sometimes called traumatic brain injury or mild brain injury, and it's probably one of the most discussed injuries in all of medicine. It was first described in 10 AD, so doctors have been aware of concussions for a long time. The brain is bathed inside the skull as a closed space, and the brain is bathed in cerebral spinal fluid, which is meant to protect the brain from minor injuries. But this doesn't do much for really major injuries. And then, of course, you can have everything from a mild concussion to an epidural hematoma with bleeding around the brain, which is so great that it displaces the brain out of the cranial vault and the brain herniates, and it's a cause of sudden death. So, Dan, why don't you talk about your concussion?
Well, I didn't die, but it was pretty bad. Carl Barzilaskis, 6'8", 300-pounder for the New York Jets, and he had a guy blocking him in front who just whiffed. So I go back to pass, and here comes Carl. Fortunately, I knew him from an All-Star game, and we were not good friends, but we were acquaintances, and he could have killed me. I really believe that if he had taken me all the way to the ground. He just kind of ran through me, and the first thing that hit was the back of my head on the turf, and it cracked the back of my helmet, and I was out. But I thanked him a couple years later when I saw him for not killing me, because if he landed on me at 300 pounds and a full head of steam, it would have been really bad.
And
excuse me, Brent, when you ever see a player hit the back of his head on the ground, that is probably the worst type of hit a player can take. Because you get hit first by, the tackler, and he drives you to the ground in the back of your head, and as Brent said, the brain is just shaking violently in your skull.
One of the worst injuries we see is just because of the mechanism that Dan just described. If you think of the brain bathed in cerebral spinal fluid sitting in our skull, the worst injuries and the worst concussions come not from a direct blow, but also when there's a rotational injury. And when that happens, you get what we call a diffuse axonal injury, where there's actually a ripping and tearing of the neurons or the cells of the brain, which can cause really major problems. I know when we were discussing that day, Dan, I asked you about the helmet and how protective the helmet was. And you told me something, and I'm just going to put it up here, and maybe you can verify that this is what is written or as a label inside the helmet.
Yeah, right on the back of the helmet, they got this little sticker. And I don't know how many of my teammates could even read, but this is what it said. Do not use this helmet to butt, ram, or spear an opposing player. Well, what else do you do when you're playing football? These are all the things you do as a tackler or a blocker, is you're taught to stick your head right in there. But the league, of course, is very aware of problems, so they had that sticker on there to make sure that the players wouldn't do that.
And you can be penalized for that.
Absolutely, and I think it's a great rule, and it's starting to take effect.
In fact, about the time that you were entering your career, you know that the competition committee has been around forever. But Rich McKay, who has been the chairman of the competition committee for at least 20 years, he's the president of the Atlanta Falcons, who was the president of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. When he first started as a member of the competition committee, the rules were all geared towards making the game a better game. Over the years, today, 80 to 85% of every rule change has to do with player health and safety, which was not true in 1975.
And I
you
think
still got 15 years.
I think we wouldn't be having this talk now, would we?
And I think what Dr. York has just said is really verified by the what we've learned about concussions. The brain is obviously a critical organ in the body, and I think it goes beyond professional football. I think the lessons learned about what you've just said, John, and protecting and thinking about protecting players has rippled down, and I think it's very much had an impact in our young athletes, whether it's high school or Pop Warner football. And I can tell you from my experience, you mentioned that I had spent some time at Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, where our wounded warriors are taken from Iraq and Afghanistan. They all had extremity injuries because they wore body armor, so most of them had lost many of them had lost extremities, but they all had head injuries, and they all had severe concussions, which we didn't recognize initially from the explosion. So the brain can be shocked by an improvised explosive device from a roadside bomb as well as one of these helmets. And those guys, those wounded warriors, talk about what are we learning in professional football, because they're all professional football fans. What are you learning about how we're being injured that can help football players, and how can what's happening to us help them?
And interestingly, the NFL and the DOD both recognize that, and for the past 3 years, the two have been working together on helmets, sensors. The injuries are not exactly the same, but we can learn from each other.
Absolutely. So we've talked about concussions. Let's go through a few more injuries. We want to save some time for Q&A with you folks. So what about left ankle sprain? That doesn't sound very serious. I was sort of surprised you remembered this one, Dan.
Well, I remember it because it was 12 degrees outside in Bloomington, Minnesota, and I came to the sideline and they wanted to wrap an ice bag on it. So I'll just air this baby out. Okay, go on. Let's go. Everybody has a sprained ankle.
As a trauma surgeon, I was particularly interested when Dan talked about this, because a transverse process fracture, it takes a lot of force to fracture a transverse process. If you think of your spine, and we actually have a pointer here, and if you look at these little protrusions coming out from the spine, those are the transverse processes. They're short, they're thick, they're strong, and it takes a lot of force to break one of those. And Dan's injury here was a transverse process fracture, mechanism being a knee drop by Cody Jones. Dan?
Well, and it was a preseason game, which really makes it even worse. But I was starting to get to be a better player and at this time in my career. Coryell had been there in 79, 78, and so this is the second year with him, and things were starting to click. And so you're going to see the rest of this. A lot of these next slides are all going to be cheap shots. And that's what happens when they're trying to get you out of the game. And I was on the ground. I'd already been knocked down. And basically this fellow who was a San Jose State grad. Any San Jose State grads here? Good. Anyway. So you know the knee drop then. But he's 280 pounds, and he just dropped a knee right in the small of my back. And that's
that's what it would take to fracture. I'm amazed even that would break it. I think the good news here is that there was not a injury which would disrupt the continuity of the bony spinal column. And if that happens, then, of course, that's what protects the spinal cord. And we all hear about people who are rendered quadriplegic, means you're paralyzed from the neck down, or paraplegic, meaning you're paralyzed from the waist down. So I think you came out of that pretty well, Dan.
Well, and karma plays a big role in sports. Cody Jones got his later on that year when he tore his Achilles. I'm not saying anything, you know, not saying he had it coming. But those things happen.
A double groin pull during a pregame warm-up, and, you know, I was particularly interested. These are the muscles in the groin. You know where your groin is, where your leg joins your body. A lot of big muscles insert on your pelvic bone there. And I'm not quite sure how you would do a double groin pull.
Well, I'll tell you how I did it. This is a week after the knee drop. And so the doctor thought that before we play the Seahawks in the Kingdome, which was a first league game, that he could numb my back and I could play. And boy, did he numb it good. He numbed it so good that I pulled both groins in pregame warm-up, but didn't feel it until the plane ride home 3 hours later.
So that was a doctor's error. I knew we'd
get that. He was the assailant on that, the doctor.
This is an interesting one from my point of view. This is all about torque, I think.
Yeah, this was explained to me. I had a calcium buildup between the two bones, the tibia and the fibula. Is that right?
Yeah.
I got those right?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. And it comes from throwing thousands and thousands of passes where you're just torquing this left leg. And, you know, I got kind of skinny legs, so the calcium started to build up there, and it built up to a point where they joined the two bones, and I had to have it operate on. And I remember laying on the operating table and hearing ching, 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 ching. So I tried to look up over the curtain there, you know, where they have the curtain there, and the doctor gave a nod to the anesthesiologist, and I just laid back down. It turned out he had a hammer and a chisel, and he was chiseling this piece of calcium. And that happened twice. They had to go in and do it twice.
Now, you were either fortunate or not that we don't have a football here tonight, but I have to tell you, Dan and I have given this lecture a couple of times. It may sound like the first time, but
yeah, sure does.
Believe it or not, we've given it a couple of times, and one of them was at an elegant library in downtown La Jolla, California.
There you go again.
There was a beautiful chandelier, and Dan said this. He said he wanted to demonstrate the throwing motion, and he said, can anybody here catch a ball? And about that time, Mike Haynes walked in, who was working with Callaway Golf at the time down in San Diego. And
Mike Haynes is a Hall of Famer, played with the Raiders, caught a lot of my passes. He was a defensive back.
So Dan said, well, great. Mike, you can catch. And Mike was very smart. He said, no, Dan, that chandelier. Dan said, look, I get this is what I get paid for. Throw in this thing and you can catch it. I made you, an all-pro defensive back. So he's saying, no. And Dan goes back and he rifles this perfect pass the length of this auditorium, clipping the crystal chandelier, which showers shards of glass over the entire audience. As a trauma surgeon, I'm thinking, oh, my God, we've got people with glass in their eye and so on. And before I could say anything, I remember what you said to me. Brent, what's everybody worried about? I completed the pass, didn't I? And besides that, it was tipped. And
So that's what I told my lawyer, too.
So that's the cause. Left wrist fracture, Dan?
Well, you get hit and you're trying to break your fall, and so my hands are behind me as I'm hitting the ground, and just broke my left wrist. And the good thing about this injury, if there is one, it's not very painful, and you could put a brace on it and you could continue to play, which I did. So, but again, late hit, Clay Matthews, you know, another cheap shot. Now, speaking of cheap shots, here you go.
This was AC, acromioclavicular separation. Remember, we saw the broken clavicle early on, and we saw the clavicle, so you already know that anatomy. Well, this is where the clavicle is connected to the very complex, probably one of the most complex joints in the human body, and one of the most fragile is the shoulder joint. And the acromioclavicular joint is where the clavicle joins really the shoulder bone. And again, it takes a tremendous blow to separate that. So, Dan?
Well, Lawrence Taylor was a great player. He's a Hall of Famer. And first time I ever really experienced how great a player he was. And, Brent, if you'll come over here, I'll be him and you be me. And you stand there, okay? Which arm? You just threw the pass. Okay?
All right.
Throw the ball. Okay. He reached around, grabbed my arm, pinned it to my side, and then pushed me into the ground with his body on top of me. It was a brilliant play on his part, because if he doesn't grab my arm, I can maybe break my fall. But by pinning my arm down to the side and down into the ground, he separated my shoulder. The cheap shot.
Anybody else want to feel the demonstration of... You should have played defensive end, Dan.
I get fired up.
Dan and I were tennis partners as well, and I can tell you that I think even though Dan couldn't get back at people like Lawrence Taylor, we were in a couple of tennis matches where Dan got hit by an... I know you're a tennis player. Dan got hit by an errant ball, totally innocent. And I think we got kicked out of one of the tournaments that we were in the finals for because Dan retaliated with an overhead against the opponent. But that's... I'm not saying you're aggressive, Dan. You're just a competitor. Rotator cuff, same area, same part of the body.
Yeah, and this, again, remember how I broke my thumb against the Green Bay Packers and Ted Hendricks? Andre Tippett, a black belt in karate, Hall of Fame linebacker for the Patriots, just as I'm throwing the ball, he hit my arm there and stopped my arm, but my shoulder kept going, and that's where I stretched the rotator cuff. But... I mean, come on, black belt in karate? That was a clean play, though. I'll give it to him.
I think this was a triple, a trifecta, Dan. Left groin, yeah. Left knee, back strain, one hit.
This was really ugly because it happened in slow motion. And these two guys coming free, two linebackers, two great linebackers, and it just caught me in a, you know, after, it always seems like it's after you throw. And you're watching on television, and you're watching the ball. You rarely see what happens to the quarterback. But they rolled me up, and because of one knee was down here and over the back, and that was a bad set of injuries there because it hurt everywhere.
This is another knee injury. And I think we've already talked about that. Was there anything particular about Reggie Camp?
Well, defensive lineman, and Reggie, I think it's a Cal grad. Any Cal grads here? It seems like, yeah. Okay. I think Bob Sarlat here, ladies and gentlemen, I played with Reggie Camp, didn't you? Or was it Walter Camp? So, you're in the pocket, you know, and everything's good, and you throw the ball, and all of a sudden a guy is rolling into your leg, and you tear your MCL. And what defensive linemen are taught is if they get knocked down is to roll to the pocket. At least they used to be taught that way. They can't do that now. You can't hit the quarterback low, and you can't hit the quarterback high, and you can't really hit him in the middle either anymore. So, but back in those days, that's what they were taught. You know, and then... You want to see all hell break loose is throw an interception. Because all those defensive linemen, now they can hit you. And they can go after you because you know you threw the interception. And I threw 242 of them, but not one of them was my fault. But they go after the quarterback like gangbusters. Well, this is related to the calcium deposit on the fibula. And luckily, because I had hurt my knee a number of times, I was starting to wear these braces. And the brace actually saved my knee, but the force of the blow, it was Reggie White of the Eagles, he broke my leg. And the interesting thing about that was that the next week, it was a fracture that wasn't too bad. I mean, I might have been able to play, but my backup was Mark Herman, and we were playing in Kansas City, and he was having a great day, and we were down in the red area, and he ran the ball and got knocked out of bounds at the one-yard line and literally knocked out. And so Coach Coryell says, "Can you go?" And I said, "Well, we're on the one-yard line. I think I can give you a play." So I kind of walked out to the huddle, and my teammates are going, "Come on, let's go, delay a game, you know." So I pitched the ball back to Muncy, and he scored a touchdown. And I walked back to the sideline. I went right over to Herman. I said, "Are you okay?" By that time, he was.
We're going to move through these last injuries so we have some time for the Q&A. Broken ribs, what you said here, Dan, many times, many ways, many places, and we know these are incredibly painful. I don't know.
Well, the good thing is now quarterbacks all wear their flak jackets, and we never used to wear those until we had many times, many places, many ways, many teams. And the other thing about the ribs is that you can play with broken ribs and cracked ribs and bruised ribs if you get enough Novocaine in your side. And I spent 40 minutes one day getting shot because they shoot above the rib, below the rib, behind the rib, and whichever the area is. And the only way they can see if it's working is to press on your ribs. You can imagine the pain there. But anyway, a lot of...
Well, this is our last injury, and Dr. York asked me if Dan was my patient, and actually not. We were friends, and I was interested in his injuries, and I was a Charger fan, but I did get a call from Dan one night of this game when he had had a broken nose and was bleeding, finished the game, of course, went home and was bleeding profusely. When I went up to see him, his bed was soaked with blood and had to take him into the emergency room where Robert Singer, a very good plastic surgeon, had to reduce his nasal fracture because there was a spicule of bone through a small artery that was keeping it pumping and bleeding. And we took care of him. Now, you can't read what Dan wrote here, but he coined a new phrase. He said to my friend, "Thanks for aiding in my displaced nasal fracture. Rest assured of being aware that the risk of redisplacement and recurrent epistaxis, that my number one oncologist is nearby," bombs away Dan. And I said, "Dan, I'm not an oncologist. I'm a trauma surgeon." I said, "An oncologist is a cancer specialist." Dan said, "Oh, I thought an oncologist was a doctor who was always on call." So
I call him all the time.
So that was the last injury that I put up, Dan. Do you want to say anything about that one?
Well, first of all, if you go back to the previous slide, Sean Jones, I think, yeah, Sean Jones, big guy. There's not enough room to go in the face mask this way. But if you turn your wrist this way and come in like that, which he did, then you strike pay dirt if you're him. Now, that hurt a lot. But when Brent took me to this little tiny guy, Singer, 5'2", 125 pounds, so I'm on this, like a dentist chair in his office, and he's over here like a mad scientist. And he turns around, he comes at me like this, and he says, "You think that big raider hurt you yesterday? Wait till you see what I do to you now." And he had a needle that long. And you know where he went with that needle? Right up the nose. I looked like the St. Louis Arch in that chair.
Well, that is the last injury. And I know Joe has some questions. So
can I just tell everybody I'm feeling fine?
Well, hopefully none of these questions will injure anyone. But I want to thank Dan Fouts, former San Diego Chargers Hall of Fame pro quarterback and NFL analyst for CBS Sports. Dan, Dr. Brent Eastman, Chief Medical Officer of Scripps Health in La Jolla, California, and President-elect of the American College of Surgeons. And also Dr. John York, physician and co-chairman of the San Francisco 49ers. So my name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll moderate tonight's audience question period. Gentlemen, we have a number of questions, so let's begin. I've tried to sort the questions so that we can leverage the knowledge of Dr. Eastman and Dr. York, our medical experts, on the one hand, and the professional football knowledge of our Hall of Fame quarterback and CBS NFL analyst Dan Fouts on the other. I assume, in fact, I encourage all of you to chime in and comment on all the questions. Well, the first question is an interesting one from the audience, and it talks about a conflict of interest. Isn't there a conflict if the physician that a player reports to after an injury is an employee of the team? How does a physician balance those responsibilities? And is it commonly being addressed by the NFL as an issue? Maybe Dr. York can talk to this.
I think that's a very good question. Interestingly, what I'll do is I will start by saying that I've been involved and around the physicians of the San Francisco 49ers since 1978. I don't know why the 49ers are the way they are, but since 1978, I have never seen a player who has a relationship with the head team physician or an orthopedic surgeon that the player's health and safety didn't come first, and there was no interference from a head coach, a general manager, an owner, or anyone else. Now, I am now the chairman of the Health and Safety Committee of the owners, and I am frequently reminded by a number of physicians that that's not the case at all organizations. But we're getting closer and closer to that. Paul Tagliabue introduced the idea that health and safety should always come above competition. Roger Goodell has made it even more emphatic. And there are lines of communications for players who feel if they are being challenged to do some of the things, even some of the things that Dan is doing. The idea of a coach asking you with a broken hand to see if you can take a snap, I really am not sure that that would happen today. I know it wouldn't happen at the 49ers, and I can safely say I don't think it would happen at most, but I won't say not all of the NFL clubs because of the mandates that have come down from the league and the way that we have put the power of taking care of the players in the hands of the physician, with no interference by coaches, general managers, ownership, et cetera.
Well, I think as a physician, I would just say that I don't think physicians take it lightly that you take an oath of Hippocrates. And the fundamental there is that it's, no matter, there's always a lot of conflict of interest. It really has to come down to me as your surgeon and you as my patient. And if anything ever interferes or takes precedence over that, then that that physician has really violated the most sacred code of medicine.
You know, today I understand that quarterbacks have microphones or speakers in their helmets so they can receive plays and strategies and so forth. But the next question talks about technology in the prevention of long-term damage, and I think, Dr. Eastman, you touched on this in your remarks about special sensors. And I've researched a little bit about special sensors that can decipher neurological brain activity and would be placed on the inside of players' helmets. So it's probably a long way to go before that's really perfected, particularly you got a microphone in there, a speaker in there, if you put another special sensor in there, you got all these issues. I mean, I'm glad that you can hear me with a clip-on microphone. So can you comment on those special sensors and also any other improvements that might be
along the way? Dan can comment on the microphone because I'm interested in that. We are very interested in at my healthcare system at San Diego Scripps, we have an institute of looking at wireless medicine. And sensors are becoming incredibly important, where we can monitor patients thousands of miles away, whether it's the heart or whether it's the brain. And what you're talking about is there's a lot of important work going on now to actually build not the microphone that the quarterback listens to, but to have sensors built into the helmet so that when there is impact, they can act, because it's very hard to grade a concussion, but you can certainly grade the degree of impact that particular hit took. So, and that can be transmitted wirelessly, that can be correlated with MRIs and CT scans, and I think we'll see in the next 5 to 10 years that will be used experimentally to try to better judge what's happening to the brain.
And there's no way of preventing a concussion, okay? Any sensors is not going to, the helmet's no. not going to prevent concussion. What we're trying to do is have the young athletes, the high school age athletes, now take a test before the season so you have a baseline. And then when a concussion happens, they retest the player and they can tell just how severe it is based upon the baseline. Now, you might be surprised. This isn't just football players. This is girls' soccer, volleyball, baseball, obviously basketball. All sports are now... Dick's Sporting Goods came out with a study, a program a couple years ago where they are offering free testing to high school age students. So you get that baseline so that you don't hurry the player back too soon, so that the baselines are the same before they let the player go back to play.
Dr. York.
Joe, the NFL has been monitoring injuries on a regular basis with computerization for over 30 years. We were the first major sport to do that. A committee was started in 1994 called the Minimal Traumatic Brain Injury, a committee that published about 17 papers, all on concussions and related injuries that were all peer-reviewed. Roger Goodell felt like that we needed to strengthen that committee and change the emphasis to the Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, with the chairman of those committees being Rich Ellenbogen, who's the head of neurosurgery up at the University of Washington in Seattle, and Hunt Bajer, who is the head of neurosurgery at Northwestern. There are 6 subcommittees on there, and I'll touch on 2 of them. One is the Helmet and Sensor Committee that is headed by Kevin Guskowitz at the University of North Carolina. And this is where we're working with the DOD. And right now, the DOD is looking at sensors in the top of the helmet because theirs are blast impacts. Ours are different. We're looking at both a mouth guard and multiple sensors in helmets. And we're hoping to have those prototypes ready to be put into helmets at the beginning of next season. But this has been much more difficult than we ever thought. A different group that's working on foot and ankle has been doing this and looking at injuries of primarily the foot with Liz Frank, with high ankle sprains, and with turf toe. And the people who are doing that are the people that have come out of the auto crash tests. And a lot of good work is coming there. Going back to head, neck, and spine, another one of the groups is called the Advocacy Group, which is Stan Herring up at the University of Washington in Seattle. And before the NFL got involved, there were only 4 states who had concussion laws for kids in high school that also apply sometimes to college and what the rules are about return to play. The NFL has gotten involved, put a big push on it, and we now have it in 38 states. So 38 states now have concussion laws that apply for peewee football for all the way up through high school and in some cases college. And we need to get those other states on board and get all of them on board, but we've got 38 done now.
Joe, I'd like to make one punctuation point on that. John, mentioning the Department of Defense working on what's happening with wounded warriors, what we're thinking about with athletes, our children, whether they're playing soccer or football. And I learned something when I was in Landstuhl, Germany, taking care of these wounded warriors. And a general in the army said something to me, and it really speaks to the collaboration of what we're learning with these blast injuries in Afghanistan and Iraq today and how it's going to pertain to our athletes. And that is a quote from the Mayo brothers in World War II, where they said, "The only victor in war is medicine." That's all I'll say.
Thank you. Very quick break before we continue. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, where we are discussing pro football injuries and lessons for the rest of us. Our panelists are Dan Fouts, former San Diego Chargers Hall of Fame pro quarterback and NFL analyst for CBS Sports, Dr. Brent Eastman, chief medical officer of Scripps Health in La Jolla, California, and president-elect of the American College of Surgeons, and Dr. John York, physician and co-chairman of the San Francisco 49ers. Now, here's one that we all probably have discussed many times. Is there a difference in injuries on natural versus artificial turf? We see it. Stadiums are built. Stadiums are torn down. They replace artificial turf with natural turf, and they go back again. Who would like to comment on that?
Well, artificial turf, when it first came out, was thought to be a great idea. It was Astrodome in Houston, Texas, was the first place to have it. University of Washington was second. University of Oregon was right there as well. And the reason that Washington and Oregon had it, because it rained so much and they needed a dry field. The turf nowadays is excellent. It's better than playing on grass. The footing is better. The cushioning is better. It's just playing better. So as far as injuries are concerned, I don't know the numbers, if there's more on grass or more on this new turf. But I do know that there was more injuries on AstroTurf and Tartan Turf, the old stuff when it first came out, than there was on grass. So the tough thing about that is that there was no padding. There was like a half an inch of foam padding underneath the carpet, and then there's concrete. And I just remember having played on it and throughout college and then a couple of years in the NFL on artificial surface, is that your legs after a game would feel like tuning forks. It would just be vibrating from this because you're playing basically on concrete, especially in cold weather places where that foam now is shrunk because of the cold weather, and it just is so hard. But today, what the fields they have are fantastic.
And I'm not gonna take any time, but the NFL, under their injury surveillance group, does have a group that looks at foot and ankle. And for the last 3 years, we've been working with all of the turf manufacturers, and I can agree with what Dan just said. If you go back, the turf was not good. Today, the turf is good. And that's important because high schools are putting it into all of their stadium.
We're running short on time, but I'm going to try to squeeze in a few extra questions. Question about rugby. Rugby is another violent contact sport. It's played without helmets. What is the incidence of concussions in rugby compared to American football?
It's not as much. And it's not as much because the players, because they don't have helmets, don't use their head. They use their shoulder, their arms to tackle. There's some thought, I mean, the game of pro football, all football changed when they put face masks on the helmet. Because that allowed coaches to teach, you see what you hit. You could stick your nose right in there, not break your nose. When they had leather helmets and no face mask, the game was different. There weren't as many concussions, I almost can guarantee you that. And they were certainly a different type of game because players use their shoulders. And that's what we're trying to get back to now with the rule changes in the NFL that are trickling down to college and to high school, where now if you lead with your head on a defenseless player, it's a penalty. And there's trying to teach these players, especially at a younger age, to tackle more with your shoulder and not so much with your head and concussions and neck injuries there.
Dan, let me ask this next question to you. It's about what's called Bounty Gate. One of the best football games I've ever seen in my life was last year's game, 49ers against the New Orleans Saints. It was a terrific game. But just after that, it came out that there's something called Bounty Gate. Dan, in your opinion, did the Saints just get caught in doing this, or is this kind of a bounty or slush fund? Is it fairly common, in your view, in the NFL?
Well, first of all, I don't think all the facts are in just yet as to what went on. The players involved and the coaches involved are still disputing the league findings. I just think that what happened is there was arrogance on the part of a defensive coach who allowed a film crew into his meeting. He used language that is common in many pep talks, many locker rooms, many meeting rooms. But that language to you folks would be offensive. But that's the game. It's a violent game. You have to be totally into it at all costs. You're trying to support your family, make a living. Players will do, especially players on the edge, will do just about anything to make a team. These players involved, whether they paid each other off or not, I find that hard to believe, because the look at the amount of money that was involved, a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there, these guys are making millions. You know, I just don't understand. Is there that much to be gained by a few thousand dollars? So I guess I'm not answering your question entirely. It doesn't surprise me that there's a little extra incentive at times, but I think what happened with the Saints was arrogance and ignorance.
Let me add, there actually is in the NFL bylaws that owners take part in and that coaches and general managers know. There is an anti-bounty clause. Players can be paid for performance, for interceptions, for tackles, for fumble recoveries. But there is express language that outlaws being able to get anything for hurting or knocking a player out of the game. In this particular case, I believe there is evidence to show that if a Saints player hit another player cleanly and the player got up and went back into the huddle, they got no payment. If he went to the sideline, they got paid.
But just to answer from a player standpoint, I don't think I ever played in a game. This goes back to St. Ignatius High School, where I thought that the guys that are playing against me weren't trying to get me out of the game. Okay? And I must have played in 300 games in my life. And I knew that somebody over there is out to get me. In fact, there's 11 of them over there that are out to get me. Now, whether they're getting paid off or not, it doesn't matter to me, because they're still trying to get me.
Well, I'm going to squeeze in two more quick questions, and then we're done. Thanks for your patience, everyone. Steve Gleason, former New Orleans Saints safety, has ALS. And I want to ask Dr. Eastman this question. Gleason recently said that he had his bell rung hundreds of times. Researchers at Boston University who were studying the brains of former NFL players, concluded that repeated head traumas could lead to ALS. So the question is, can repeated head traumas lead to neurological disorders as opposed to just orthopedic disorders, which we were discussing earlier?
First of all, I'm not a neurologist or a neurosurgeon, but I'll give you an opinion about it. I am a trauma surgeon, and I do know this literature to some degree. And I think the operative word in your question is could lead to, or the Boston University. I'm familiar with their research. There is an immense amount of research being done. And I think where we are in that research is that it's true, and possibly unrelated. You have people who have head injuries. You have people who have repeated head injuries in sports, quarterbacks. And then they develop a neurologic disorder like ALS or Alzheimer's or just general dementia. Based on the neurosurgeons that I talked to, and I've talked to a lot of them about this, there is no really hard evidence, hard facts to show that correlation. We do know that with brain injury, that the brain gets scrambled. We know boxers, which is probably, punch drunk or the... that syndrome probably comes closest to long-term damage due to neuronal, physiologic, as well as structural damage to the brain. As far as ALS and some of the more esoteric neurologic diseases, I do not think the answers are in on it yet. but I think we'll continue to look at it.
Well, I'm going to borrow this last question from Bob Costas, a terrific sportscaster. Bob Costas recently attended a meeting with Tom Brady, Joe Montana, Steve Young, Aaron Rodgers, and Jim Plunkett. And his main question after this meeting and this get-together was, what can be done to make the game reasonably safe without changing the basic nature and without altering the sport that is clearly America's most popular sport? I'll let Dr. York, if you want to start with that one.
That is a five-hour conversation with no answer at this point. But just as I made the comment that the competition committee, which used to work on rules to make the game better, is now 85% geared towards health and safety.
Right.
The injury surveillance, whether it be knees and ankles or whether it be the head, neck, and spine group, all of those things are being looked at to make the game safer, whether it be equipment, rules, whatever. The last CBA, collective bargaining agreement, the Players Association and the NFL agreed to put $100 million aside for research. And the NFL has just put $30 million into the hands of the NIH for them to use in the best way they believe possible to look at head injuries and the prevention of head injuries and trauma with the head. So there's a lot being done, and I don't think I can give you answers, but we are certainly tasked with making sure that this game is as safe as possible. If it's not a violent game, it's not football. I think Dan would attest to that. But it can be made safer through equipment changes, changes in helmets, the way we measure things, rules about when somebody is concussed, when they can return, all those things.
Okay, very good. So our thanks to Dan Fouts, former San Diego Chargers Hall of Fame pro quarterback and NFL analyst for CBS Sports, Dr. Brent Eastman, the chief medical officer of Scripps Health in La Jolla, California, and president-elect of the American College of Surgeons, and of course Dr. John York, physician and co-chairman of the San Francisco 49ers. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I am Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are all in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.